Today at Reader's Corner, Andrea Elliott, author of Invisible Child, Poverty, Survival, and Hope in an American City. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. We see and hear reports of inequality and poverty in America on a regular basis. But can we really understand just how it unfolds for those living it, especially for children living it? Andrea Elliott's Invisible Child, Poverty, Survival, and Hope in an American City takes the reader inside one American family and the life of a girl with responsibilities for her family that are far heavier burdens than most kids her age have. Covering 8 formative years in the life of a fiercely intelligent and imaginative young girl in a Brooklyn homeless shelter, Invisible Child intertwines the story of Dasani Coates' childhood with the history of her family, including the passage of their ancestors from slavery to the Great Migration North. Andrea Elliott is an investigative reporter for the New York Times and a former staff writer at the Miami Herald. Her reporting has been awarded a Pulitzer Prize, a George Polk Award, a Scripps Howard Award, and prizes from the Overseas Press Club and the American Society of News Editors. Invisible Child is her first book and was chosen by the New York Times as one of the 10 best books of 2021. Andrea Elliott, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Hello, Bob. Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for that beautiful intro.
Well, congratulations on this distinction. You know, as one who does nothing but pick out books and read books all year, I know how many are out there. And here you are with a book among the best 10 of the year. Did you see this coming in any way?
It was an answer to my greatest prayers, I would say. I did not take it for granted that it would happen. And I am feeling just really, really blessed that it did and hopeful that it gets people to pick this book up, because what I keep hearing from readers, and this is a book that has really found its own life on the ground by word of mouth, and it's very reader generated. And what I keep hearing back from them is, I can't put this down. I can't put this down. And I think sometimes people are afraid to open a book like this because they think it will depress them or make them sad. And what I found, and the reason I stayed in her life for all those years, was just this incredibly strong current of hope and excitement and surprise. I think there's so many ups and downs and sort of unpredictable twists and turns to her story. And that's part of, I think that's part of the reason that it has gotten the reception it's gotten.
You know, I often ask novelists when I'm discussing their works, did you outline this thing from the beginning, or did your characters take you where you wound up in plot? And I guess in a sense, I could ask that question of you. When you started writing, well, maybe I shouldn't say started writing, because that may have come a little later. When you started getting to know this family and spending time with this family, did you have any idea you were going to wind up 500 pages later?
I had zero idea. Yeah. I thought they were worth 500 plus pages. I did always think that. We're used to that kind of a length of a book when we're reading a presidential biography. Yeah. And the more I looked at Dasani's life, at her family history, at the incredible challenges that her family had survived over generations, the more I marveled at their story and thought it was worth every bit as much. I think there's just so much to take from her example. It's so interesting to hear you say that about fiction writers, because I've always wondered that about fiction writers as well. Is, you know, does the character start to talk to you and tell you what right. The story is? Because that definitely happens. I think in nonfiction, that's sort of the only way, because our job as journalists is to go in and learn. We are actually students. We're not teachers. We're not arriving on the scene with the story in hand and all mapped out, right? We're there to learn what the story is. And the characters are the guides. They are the people who show us the way. And every pivotal moment of this book, it was Dasani or her mother Chanel or her stepfather Supreme or this history of her great-grandfather June. All of these people were the guides. And I was just constantly surprised by what I found. I never predicted what was coming next. I wrote mm-hmm. the end 3 different times, and all three endings are in this book. they just happen to end a certain chapter rather than the whole thing, because then something new would happen that took it in a different direction, and it deepened. The portrait deepened the longer I stayed with them.
So how did you find Dasani and her family?
So I wanted to write about poor kids. I had rediscovered Alex Kotlowitz's seminal work, There Are No Children Here, about 20 years after it came out, and went back through that book. This was 2012, thinking, how much has really changed? And then researched a little bit and found that 1 in 5 American children were still living in poverty. And that's the exact same rate, child poverty rate, as when Alex Kotlowitz's book came out in the 80s. And that set me down this path, because I just thought, you know, that's the highest child poverty rate of any developed nation in the world, and by far of any superpower. How did we get here? And what is that like? And what does it mean for 1/5 of the nation's future workforce to be growing up in adversity? What does it mean for our future? And the problem with poverty reporting is that it's not the problem, but it's the reality, is that people understandably have really intense emotional reactions when they read about the poor. They tend to either blame the system or they blame the person. And those are the two major camps. And so in poverty reporting around adults, you see that. You see a lot of debate. Oh, it's that person's fault. That person lacks personal responsibility. That person wants to live off the government. And I just really wanted to get inside the experience of kids, because I always want to write stories that reach everyone across the political spectrum. And no matter where you sit on that spectrum, it's really hard to argue that more than 16 million children are responsible for their predicament, that they made the wrong choices. Whether their parents are responsible or not, they're growing up like this. What's that like? What does that mean for us? And so that's what led me, that question, to the steps of the Auburn Family Residence, which was this decrepit homeless shelter in Brooklyn. And I was standing outside for days interviewing mothers, just trying to find a way in. It was closed to the public. And that's where I saw Dasani. She walked right out one day with her mother and her 7 siblings, and she just immediately caught my attention.
So tell us where Dasani gets her name.
Dasani was named for the bottled water that had debuted. It's a Coca-Cola product, had come out the year before she was born, and it had just hit the shelves of the bodegas in Brooklyn where she would be growing up. And her mother saw this bottled water and thought, who would pay for water? It just seemed like another world to Chanel. Now, Chanel is her mom's name. She was named after another liquid that is bottled and sold. It was the fancy perfume that her own mother saw in a magazine ad. Because back then in the 70s in Brooklyn, an ad in a magazine was the closest you could get to this other world. And now in 2001, Chanel was holding this product in her hand that spoke of this other world, because that world had come to Brooklyn. The people who could, to answer a question, afford that water were living in her neighborhood. They were coming in. And over the next 10 years, the first 10 years of Dasani's life, there was this meteoric change in Brooklyn. And I think part of what this book looks at that is different from There Are No Children Here, and that I would hope builds on that narrative and adds sort of important new chapter, is the contemporary experience of growing up poor in the American city, where we've had a return of wealth, a revitalization, gentrification, people coming back in and trying to create new life in these cities. At the same time that there are many poor kids living in those spaces, what's that like to grow up? I wanted to know, what's it like to grow up poor in the richest city in the world? She was growing up surrounded by that wealth in her own neighborhood, waking up in a homeless shelter, crammed in one room with 9 family members. There were mice running around. She could step outside that shelter and she could walk past, within a few steps, townhouses that were selling for millions. And that was a totally new experience for me. I wanted to understand what that was like.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Andrea Elliott. She's the author of Invisible Child, Poverty, Survival, and Hope in an American City. So tell us about Supreme, Dasani's stepfather, and Chanel, her mother. theirs is a tough life, especially given the fact that there's a drug history involved. And I'd also like for you to include in your answer something that I learned in your book. When Chanel came into this world, what was happening to New York City, which today, by the way, as you say in your book, has 22,000 homeless children. But what was happening in the city at the time with large numbers of African Americans moving in to find work, but a city and its economy that was apparently changing?
Yes. So an outsider would look at Chanel and Supreme and see, to put it bluntly, drug addicts, two people who have lost at the game of life, who have failed at every measure. Because they were homeless when I met them, they'd been in the shelter system for a long time. They had between them eight children. They struggled to find work. And their addictions are rooted in childhood traumas that spun out of that era that was very, very definitive for poor New Yorkers of the 70s in places like Brooklyn and also places like Detroit and Chicago and Los Angeles. Industry had pulled out of the city, and the Black middle class had also left in large part. And what remained was a deeply poor, very isolated community in need of work. And when that predicament then meets the arrival of crack cocaine, which is cheap cocaine that is smoked rather than snorted, which then creates this whole alternate economy, it's a much more complicated story than people realize. They think about the crack epidemic and crack babies, and there's sort of these ways we have of kind of like writing off that whole moment as just a despairing, horrible time, which of course it was. But it was a much more complicated thing than that. It was also a system that gave, for instance, Chanel, Dasani's mother, her first taste at how to be an entrepreneur. She mm-hmm. was running a crack den and bringing in tons of money and in charge of people and learning to be a boss. This is someone who didn't have beyond a ninth grade education, but has tremendous skills. So from the outside, you look at them, you say they have criminal records. They are a disaster. What I saw going deep inside their world and being allowed in by them, which took a long time to get that kind of access, and then I stayed with them for years in their lives, was a very, very different portrait. I would describe them as survivors of serious childhood traumas and a lack of opportunity. Supreme wound up swept up in the crack trade and went to prison when he was 17, and then got a GED in prison, was self-taught, came out, and he and Chanel took on a new religion in a sense. They decided to leave behind the street life and join a kind of offshoot of the Nation of Islam. And they very purposefully decided to marry and to form a family. And they had big hopes and dreams for themselves. And they kept slipping because they were self-medicating, because they did not have access to the right kinds of therapy and help that I think a lot of middle-class families take for granted. I think one of the most powerful points of this book is when you look at a lot of white families, my family included, my father's side, my mother's from South America, but my father's from upstate New York. You see that in the 50s, a lot of our wealth was cemented in real estate at the same time that Black families were prohibited from becoming homeowners and from a bunch of other important steps toward the middle class that they were not able to cross over. And you see this very much in Dasani's family with her great-grandfather, who was a war hero, came back from World War II, but was denied as a triple Bronze Star service star veteran, was denied the same GI Bill supports that his white comrades got, was unable to buy a home in the suburbs, couldn't even get to the suburbs, wound up stuck in the projects. Tried his best to work, but labor unions were closed. He was trained as a mechanic, and he wound up working over 30 jobs, just cobbling together a living while trying to raise his family as New York slipped into this period that we just discussed. And so there was no safety net in that family. In my family, if somebody, and I have a sibling who struggles mightily with addiction, And for decades, we have done everything we can to help him and put him in rehab. And there is a safety net there. I think that if that safety net had existed for Chanel and Supreme, they would have been in a very different place in their lives by the time they hit their 30s. And, you know, they've given me a lot of advice about my brother. It's interesting. They know so much. They're really wise. They're very well read. They are people with, I would say, tremendous aspirations for their lives and nobility, frankly. They mess up like everyone else. This is a dysfunctional family. There's no question. But what family isn't? This is what I always think. I mean, this is in some ways, this book is like a telenovela. This is what my mother, who's from Chile, always says, you know, it's like a smart telenovela. You mix policy with all these dramatic things that happen. It's like, it's a saga. But at the end of the day, what I'm left with is that nothing is stronger than the love in this family, and the bond that keeps them together is their most powerful system of survival.
Let's talk about the agencies that this family must deal with. You call it a sprawling social service system that forms the triumvirate of Dasani's life. And there apparently are three pillars of power. I wonder if you could share with us how Chanel looks at this system. And then I'd like to know what your own personal take is on it after working with this family and seeing these agencies work for 8 years.
That's such a great question. One thing I did not want this book to be was something dry where the reader's eyes would glaze over, and we're in the alphabet soup now of agencies, and now you're going to learn about this agency. I avoided that at all costs. And then I hit a problem, which was that my editor said, Andrea, you have to explain the agencies. You can't just tell the story. And I will never forget, Dasani came and met me that day, and I was really struggling because the way I like to write is I like things to come alive, and I want people to be excited even if they're reading, even if they're eating their spinach, okay? If I'm describing something really dry and mundane, I still want it to be riveting to them. And what I've learned over the course of my career is that people will stay with a story if they care about the person in it. And they will do that. They'll eat whatever spinach they need in order. Dasani's problems become your problems when you read this book. And then you want to understand those problems. But not only is that the case, it's also the case that she helped me figure out how to get past that huge stumbling block. Because she came that day and she said, what's wrong? And I said, I don't like writing about systems. I really just want to write about the people. I don't know how to even describe these systems. They're so complicated and they overlap. And she looked at me and I said, Dasani, if you could describe these systems, like just close your eyes and try to imagine them. What do you see? And she closed her eyes and she saw a map. She saw all these acronyms that mean nothing to people, but that are essential to her survival. DHS, the Department of Homeless Services, that's in the Bronx. ACS, Administration for Children's Services, that's in Brooklyn. HRA, the Welfare Department, Human Resources Administration, that is in Queens. And that day, I found my way into how to write about this, which is, it's a visual map. And it's actually at the start of the book, you see New York City. Mm-hmm. It's like any tourist map. There's the Empire State Building. But then you see these acronyms. It's almost a parallel map that's only seen by the poor. And they know these agencies because they rely on them. They depend on them. And they don't depend on them is what I found, and to get to your question, in the way that I think a lot of people assume. I think folks like to think, or often think, you know, someone like Chanel's living off of HRA, that's welfare. She wants to be on welfare and not working. She needs her food stamps because she's lazy. And I remember telling Chanel that one day, saying, you know, people talk about welfare, Queens. What do you think about that? It was ironic because the welfare agency's in Queens, in New York. And I'd stood in line with Chanel and those agencies for so long. There's a photograph of us asleep on the bench. The two of us had fallen asleep, and Dasani took this surreptitious photo just to kind of get back at me for taking so many photos of her. I mean, hours and hours and hours spent in these lines. The poor pay with their time. Wealthy people can pay a fee and beat the line and, you know, get things expedited. Right. So why would you do that? And Chanel said, I'd love to meet the woman who would endure childbirth six times over. She'd had six herself and Supreme brought in the other two for some extra food stamps that don't last the end of the month. I think that it's so complicated, and I hope that you read the book and you'll see how these systems interact. I think there's great things about them. I think that Chanel wanted nothing more than to be independent and not rely on them. And the best example I have of that is that she refused to apply for disability benefits for her children or for herself, even though they would have qualified and that would have brought in at least another $1,000 a month. She refused because she didn't want them to feel, to internalize that label. There's a lot of pride in this family and a lot of will to transcend. And I think that the systems are just another part of their universe. And it's they're human systems, by the way. They're made up of humans. And that's another very human-driven part of the story.
I'm Bob Custer, host of Reader's Corner. Today, I'm speaking with Andrea Elliott, author of Invisible Child, Poverty, Survival, and Hope in an American City. A stunning debut, the book covers eight formative years in the life of an intelligent and imaginative young girl in a Brooklyn homeless shelter as she balances poverty, family, and opportunity. So you quote one of those agencies, the Administration of Children's Services, goal of prevention, quote, to stabilize families at the risk of a crisis. And then you discuss just where the funding goes. The question I have is, how does that funding line compare with the funding that goes for foster care, in which, in this particular case, this family, I believe these kids were sent in three different directions, three different foster families at one point. What's the comparison or contrast in funding?
The most pivotal thing that happens in this book, which doesn't give it away, by the way, but I will just say, is that Dasani takes a chance and decides to leave home to go to a boarding school in rural Pennsylvania. And in her absence, things fall apart. She was an integral part of her family system. And when she goes away, a lot of bad things start to happen. Her mother struggles to manage. Her stepfather struggles. Her siblings are struggling. And about 10 months later, due to suspicions that the children were being neglected, the agency called ACS puts the children in foster care and removes them from their home. And I was there that day when that happened. The thing that I'm most struck by looking back, after many years, by the way, the family was partly reunited. So I will say that much. So there is a lot of hope in this story, but it was a brutal, brutal period. And I think anyone who has a child who is not abusing that child, or most people actually who are in this system are not abusing their children. There's two kinds of ways of maltreatment. One is abuse and one is neglect. And neglect is more than 90% of the cases. Neglect is failure to provide adequate housing, adequate clothes. That's the camp that this family fell into. And it's very closely correlated to poverty. What is so striking about the money is that if you had just spent a fraction of what wound up going to paying for foster care for these eight kids on keeping this family together, we would have seen a very different outcome. I do believe that. I think the parents needed supports they weren't giving. The federal government gives 10 times as much to programs that separate families than to programs that keep families at risk together. Dasani's family, when they went into foster care, wound up costing the government $33,000 a month, which is nearly $400,000 a year, just these eight kids. And it took a social worker, actually, who was working on this case, who bravely went on the record in this book, Linda Lowe, it took her pointing it out to me early on. She said, if we would only just divert some of those funds early on, put someone in the home, maybe that's all they need is just an extra adult full-time in the home for a while. What you're avoiding is the trauma that results in the lives of eight children from being separated from their parents. There's no greater trauma. There's no greater, I would argue, act of emotional violence than separating a child from his or her parents. I am a mother. I will never be able to shake what it was like to watch those children be taken from their parents. Mm-hmm. Their parents loved them and their parents needed help. And the answer was not to put them in foster care. I just don't believe that. I think sometimes it is. Very rarely it is, but it is sometimes the answer. We hate those stories, obviously, where children are horribly abused, but they are a tiny fraction of of the reality. And I think those kids need to be protected. And at the same time, in the name of protection, what we're seeing is a massive system that separates children from their parents and sends kids down a path that is very hard to reverse. There's a pipeline from foster care to prison that is well documented, and it's a tragedy.
You mentioned the Hershey School. I was not aware of the Hershey School until I read your book. I do remember in Chicago, where I once lived, I would talk to people every now and then who talked about their wealthy families sending them to boarding schools in the East. And they were obviously removed from their families after the eighth grade. I never could get that. But anyway, here you have this young woman who's struggling in New York City, and off she goes to Hershey School. I guess the question is, how does that work out for her, and why does she leave early?
Hershey was a radical experiment in Dasani's life and in the lives of many children. There are about 2,000 children that attend this school that was started by the chocolate magnate Milton Hershey, who had no children himself and left behind his fortune to this school, which is now the richest private school in America. It has a more than $17 billion endowment, which is just staggering if you think about it. Yeah. And it's just for this pre-K to 12th grade population of 2,000 kids. The house parents are the most fascinating part of that school to my mind. These are married couples, the vast majority of them Christian. I think absent some kind of broader faith or drive to help the poor, it would be really hard to find people who are willing to do this job. They have to have children themselves, and they have to work really long hours. They get free housing, but basically they become the house parents of 12 kids, and they become surrogate parents, and they take them to soccer classes. They get braces for them. They teach them manners. It's this whole other life. And Dasani left at age 13, one experience, and went into a completely opposite one, which is that she suddenly found herself in a predominantly white town with house parents who were devoted to trying to help her succeed and thrive in sports and school. And this required a lot of vulnerability on her part. She needed to lower her guard and accept that things were going to be different, including maybe she needed to learn how to speak differently and act differently and not drop F-bombs constantly. And she tried. And in the beginning, she was thriving. And she didn't mind that she was being corrected and how she ate and spoke. She thought, look, I'm going to learn to swim in different worlds, because this was and remains a survival tactic for a lot of Dasani's own Black mentors who have made it into the upper middle class. They've said, you got to learn to do it this different ways. That's not talking white, Dasani. That can be another way of speaking that is African-American. Why do you say that they're making you sound white? They're not making you sound white. But she felt in her bones that the big message of Hershey was, you must part with your culture, with your language, with your modes of expression, with the way you dress, and above all, with your family and your bonds, in order to transcend and leave poverty behind. You need to leave in order to make it. And I think that that winds up being true for some people. Plenty of kids at Hershey graduate and do their best to move on. But for Dasani, it was untenable. She felt that she was embracing an inauthentic life by doing that, and that nothing mattered more to her than her family. And that by leaving them behind, she was leaving herself behind. Mm-hmm. And I think what her story shows us is that we need to, at the very least, broaden our definition of what success looks like for poor kids. How do we accommodate a more diverse understanding of what success looks like and feels like? Can't someone like Dasani stay put in her neighborhood and still thrive? Can she speak the way she wants to speak, dress the way she wants to speak? And she's doing that, by the way. She lives with her mother in the Bronx. She's going to community college now, and she's paving her way forward. And at the same time, feeling like she hasn't left behind what is most important to her. But that is not the child that we venerate. That's not the kid that you see in the movies or in fiction that made it out of the hood and went off to the Ivy League. I think we have a very narrow understanding of what success looks like. And I began to challenge my own assumptions, even for my own kids, about not just success, but happiness. I mean, what's the point of being at Hershey when you feel cut off from everything? That joy is the current that runs through this family the most, not sorrow, not pain. This is her sense of identity, and she's cut it off for what? What's the point of life if you can't feel that you are bonded closely with your mother?
Well, I must say we've run out of time. It goes so quickly when we're interviewing an author about such an outstanding book that has received such acclaim, Andrea. So I want to thank you, first of all, for joining us today at Reader's Corner. Secondly, remind our listeners, this is a must read. The name of the book, Invisible Child, Poverty, Survival, and Hope in an American City by Andrea Elliott. Thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thank you so much, Bob. It was really one of my favorite conversations yet.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.